How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity, back to the
diversity is as critical as biological
disorientation. In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
planet, that is the only thing which is sustainable.
The place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is
We shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential questions as much as they are systemic questions.
Action informed by knowledge of
get down
place.
To work.
You're listening to the Schumacher Conversations, a series of lively discussions featuring some of the foremost voices in the movement for a new economics. The conversations engage prominent E.F. Schumacher speakers as they reflect on past lectures and their enduring relevance given current economic, social, and ecological realities.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
Have a look at it. Wes Jackson and David Orr engaged in the following Schumacher conversation on August 13th, 2020.
Today we're having another dialogue hosted by the Schumacher Center for New Economics. We have Wes Jackson and David Orr in conversation. I'm David Bollier, the director of the Schumacher Center's Reinventing the Commons program. My life revolves around studying how the commons is emerging as a new paradigm of economics, culture, in governance. Today, we're privileged to have two towering environmental thinkers and innovators and deep humanists to help us make sense of this moment. Each is a doer, and each has decades of hard-earned experience and wisdom. Wes Jackson and David Orr. I'm so eager to hear about their take on our current situation and to have you, the audience, help question them about fruitful paths forward. I'm going to introduce both of our speakers and then tell you a few things about how we'll proceed. I'll start with Wes. Wes Jackson is a world-renowned geneticist, plant geneticist, farmer, author, and professor emeritus of biology, who's a very pioneering figure in international sustainability and agriculture. Wes gave a Schumacher lecture about 40 years ago in 1981, calling for a revolution in agriculture, and again in 1993 when he talked about the challenge of becoming native to a place. A few years ago, in 2016, he and Wendell Berry shared the Schumacher lecture stage to reflect on their long friendship as sparring partners and deep thinkers about the future of land, agriculture, food, and economics. For many years, Wes was a professor of biology at Kansas Wesleyan University and a tenured full professor at California State University, Sacramento, where he established and chaired one of the first environmental studies programs in the United States. But in 1976, he left academia to found the Land Institute, a nonprofit educational organization in Salina, Kansas. There, he conceptualized natural systems agriculture, which relies on perennial grains, perennial polycultures, and intercropping as ways to grow food in the prairie ecosystem. By using perennials that don't need to be replanted every year and don't till the soil as much, it helps prevent erosion and promotes richer, more beneficial plant-microbe relationships. Wes Jackson's work has been honored in many places over the years, including as a Pew Conservation Scholar, a MacArthur Fellow, and a Right Livelihood Laureate, which is also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. And all of this has been striving, in the words of the Smithsonian Magazine, to overthrow agriculture as we know it. Since stepping down from the presidency of the Land Institute in 2016, Wes has been deeply involved in the Ecosphere Studies program, which seeks to change the way people think about the world and their place in it through educational and cultural projects with a perennial perspective. And let me just introduce David Orr. David W. Orr is a professor at Oberlin College. For decades, he's been in the vanguard of environmental education and design, with far-reaching influence as a scholar and progressive instigator and implementer of new ideas. David gave a Schumacher lecture in 1992 on environmental literacy, education as if the earth mattered, and another one in 2002 called Walking North on a Southbound Train, which discussed why the environmental movement was failing or limited in its political strategies. David Orr's official title is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Special Assistant to the President of Oberlin College. But the truth is that the titles can't really contain his boundless energies as an environmental educator, designer, and innovator. As executive director of the Oberlin Project, he's led a partnership with the City of Oberlin, Oberlin College, and many other players to reimagine and revitalize the local economy while eliminating carbon emissions and restoring local agriculture, the food supply, and forestry. It's been a hugely ambitious project that is committed to reducing carbon emissions below zero. Years ago, David had proposed a relatively more modest goal of merely carbon neutrality for colleges and universities. And since then, hundreds of colleges and universities have made that pledge. At Oberlin, David has done his part by organizing and fundraising for a carbon neutral plan for the campus. A crown jewel of that project is the Adam Joseph Lewis Center, which in 2010 was named by the American Institute of Architecture as the most important green building of the past 30 years. The U.S. Department of Energy has hailed it as one of the 30 milestone buildings of the 20th century. I don't have time to tell you more about David's many celebrated books. I'll mention three: Ecological Literacy, Earth in Mind, and Hope is an Imperative. Suffice it to say that his leadership in the environmental world has been felt with his board affiliations with such institutions as the Rocky Mountain Institute, the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Bioneers, and World Watch Institute. His real aspiration is to change our vision of reality and provoke our ecological imagination, and I'm hoping he will do some of that in the coming hour or so. So a few notes before we get started. David and Wes will each give us 10 minutes of reflection on their past lectures and how they might update their talks for the current moment, where we've come. And then after each has spoken, we'll move on to some questions, some posed by me, but many more posed by you, the audience, which I'm told is quite large. You can ask questions through the Q&A box at the bottom right of your Zoom page. And I apologize in advance that all of your questions won't be able to be posed simply because we have too many people watching this conversation. Let me also take the opportunity to note that if you're so moved, you can support the cost of these free events by Schumacher lecturers. There's a donation on the donation button on the homepage of the Schumacher Center in the bottom right, the centerforneweconomics.org. So why don't we get started with you, Wes, perhaps reflecting on your prior conversations with Schumacher Center people and where you think we've come.
Well, I like to reflect on the conversation I had with E.F. Schumacher himself in March of 1977. Our building had burned down the previous October. We had little to show here, but Fritz, as those who knew him well — I wasn't one of them, but knew him well — was here on a tour. He's making a nationwide tour. And I was caught up in whether it was appropriate to be using the products of the Industrial Revolution to try to build a sustainable society. And I had 200 patio doors that I'd got for, $200 or $300 each. And I was thinking about greenhouses and solar collectors and so on. Was that really appropriate? And I think what he did, in a certain sense, was settle me down. Because I asked him, is it appropriate? And he walked along a while and he said, never mind, materials want to be used, they'll show you how. And that statement right there told me that we always have to begin from where we are and then do what we can to make the journey as we downpower in this world. So that, I think, helped set the stage for much of our thought. And I think my first talk that I gave at Schumacher carried some of that. He also told a story that was so useful. I've told this story many times about when he was traveling across the United States back in the 1930s. He said that they stopped somewhere in Kansas, a service station, I guess. There was a person there. He said, well, how are things, to the local? He says, oh, they're fine. So what is it you do? Said Schumacher. He says, oh, I work in that, on that farm over there across the highway. Oh, you do? Yeah, he says, he used to own that farm. But I didn't have any money, and I had to pay my hired hand in land. Now he owns the land, and I no longer have it at all. Well, that's a very sad story. Well, I work for him, and he doesn't have any money either, and I'm buying back the land. What he was illustrating was some very important principles, and that is, if you have land and you have a culture and you have a kind of neighborliness, we can make it. And that, I think, was much at the core of the idea of small is beautiful. And of course, he had been a student of Leopold Kohr. And Leopold Kohr says, don't worry about economic systems. All you have to do is get the scale right, and the economic systems will emerge. And so that's been pretty close to a constant. And it came right there in the first 6 weeks of the Land Institute's origin. And without that, it would have been a somewhat different place. I don't know how, but that's been the core of it. And in that lecture that he gave to Salinans, he also told about how lorries carry biscuits from Edinburgh to London, meeting lorries carrying biscuits from London to Edinburgh. Why don't they exchange recipes, he asked. Well, he had a way of asking those kind of questions. And that has a way of organizing our minds about the nature of the extractive economy. So I can do no better than, and I don't know how much has been added since, but I can do no better than go back to March of 1977 and that day and a half experience with your founder, the Schumacher Center.
Well, thank you, Wes. We will pick up on some of those themes in the questions and conversation, but let's move on to David. And David, you could maybe talk a little bit about where your thinking and evolution has evolved over the past 20 years or more since your lectures.
First of all, I want to start and say thank you to Susan Witt for keeping the Schumacher Center going, and to you, David, for your work on the commons, which has been really exceptional. Green Governance is one of the great books of the time, and it's been, I've used it a great deal.
Oh, thank you.
And Wes Jackson is known widely for his work on natural systems agriculture, but Wes, I've known for probably better part of 40 years, And Wes has the capacity, as he just demonstrated, to ask big questions and stretch the boundaries. And Wes, I'm in your debt for lots of conversations that have stretched my thinking and deepened what we do. So thanks to the three of you. The late John Lewis said something to the effect that make trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble, as he put it. And so between the four of us, I'm with three good troublemakers that make necessary trouble. So let me say just a few words. I was asked to say something about the original thinking, and what my early work did was to reflect what I was doing at the time. So I started in public policy, environmental policy, and then stretched into education, and then later into ecological design. That just happened to be the things that I was doing. To bring that up to the present time, I reflected a good bit on where we were when I got into this movement. I happened to be in Atlanta when I became, quote, an environmentalist or whatever that means in the movement. But the world then was a very different world. And the origins of this movement, of which we're a part, were at that time very political. Keith Caldwell, Linton Caldwell, professor at Indiana, was writing the National Environmental Policy Act, working for Henry Jackson in the U.S. Senate. William Ophuls, or Patrick Ophuls, was writing Ecology and the Politics of Scarcity. Robert Heilbronner was writing The Human Prospect, but politics was in the air. In a way, it paved the way for our early successes. And so those were the years in which we did things, and they were largely bipartisan. Nat Reed was one of the major Republican thinkers and prominent in the Interior Department and land preservation. But we passed, Nixon established the Environmental Protections Agency and the National Environmental Policy Act and Clean Air, Clean Water Act and toxic substances and so forth. And so the legislation that provided the framework for this movement in terms of the public policy was passed in that period from roughly 69 to 76 or 77. Was it perfect? No. It was not. As a movement, we were not inclusive enough. We tended to draw boundaries around cities, and we idolized countryside and wilderness to the detriment of urban environments, but all that needed to come into being. We did not include women in this, although people like Alice Hamilton and Ellen Swallow were part of the structure of thinking and certainly the scientific world. But the more I thought about this, I was trained as a political scientist and taught political science for 9 years. Politics is defined as who gets what, when, and how. And if you think of air, water, land, soils, climate stability, biological diversity, these are the what in all of this. And so there's everything about the environment that is essentially political. And I think that we lost sight of that fundamental truth, although that was the bedrock in which we had early between 1968 and 1976 or 77 built this movement. It failed. And I want to get to the very quickly just to the current issues, but it failed for a number of reasons. One, the memo written by Lewis Powell in the early 1980s.
The Supreme Court.
Pardon?
Then Chamber of Commerce director, now then later the Supreme Court justice.
Right. He was an attorney, but he wrote this for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it announced a counterattack of sorts. So what that led, it didn't do it entirely, but what it did was to break the contract between labor and capital that had established that middle class world from roughly 1940 to 1980. Money and politics did its part. And the income distribution or lack of equity in our economy tended to break that apart. Disinvestment in cities. I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, and disinvestment in cities was a major part of that. It disenfranchised literally millions of Americans. The chasm grew between public opinion. I think public opinion has always been with us, large numbers on most issues when they're properly put to the public. But the chasm grew, and the bridge that should connect public opinion and laws and regulations and so forth was broken or became a toll bridge. And the upshot of that is kind of where we are now. I don't think America has solved any major problem in the past 50 years. And so now we deal with the consequences of having done a kind of Australian walkabout from the world of politics. What to do about this, and very quickly before we get into questions, I think we know what to do. And Wes's work on the 50-year farm bill, which I hope he says more about, was one of those. What he was asking to do in terms of farm policy was to stretch the horizon. Instead of 5-year farm bills, begin to think a half a century out. David, your work on the commons is part of the solution. We know how to manage common property resources much better than we do, climate being one of those. And Susan's work on new economics. The pieces of solution are there. I'm not getting into the technology, but if someone asked, as Amory Lovins, who also gave Schumacher lectures, can we power the world by sunshine and efficiency? The answer has to come back, yes, we can. Technically, that is a matter of leadership, not so much economics and technology. So what my current work has been involved in, first, a conference that we organized in 2017 on the state of American democracy. We had 30-some speakers, starting off with Jane Mayer from New Yorker and Tim Egan from New York Times, and ending with Reverend William Barber 3 days later. That led to a book, Democracy Unchained, which came out in March of this year, just before the pandemic. We have 39 writers and original pieces in that book, including Bill McKibben and Maria Hinojosa and Rashad Robinson, Denise Fairchild, and a lot of seminal thinkers at this point. The goal is to begin to lay out a path forward from our present malaise and logjam to a wider, deeper conversation that leads eventually to practical changes. And there are lots of questions to be asked, and I'll just put one out there and then close the comments. But in thinking about our plight, the U.S. Constitution is celebrated, and we're very proud of it. But if you change the question and you ask if the founders knew then in 1787 what we think we know now about how natural systems work, how would they then have written a constitution for a world of feedback loops and natural system cycles and leads and lags and so forth? That's the world we live in. It's a world with climate change and lots of viruses and so forth. So the work that we're engaged in, we've got some 30 partner organizations from the Ford Foundation to Arizona State University to the Schwarzenegger Institute. And we're organizing 11 online events. They were going to be in-person live events, but they're now online events. And we aim to build a dialogue around building this inclusive democratic world that includes future generations, an economy, as you all at Schumacher have advocated, where prices tell the truth. We were asked, too, to comment on the current COVID pandemic. And I think that the way I see the COVID pandemic is it's kind of a preview. It's a consequence of letting democracy decay and the governance institutions that we support, including probably the Centers for Disease Control. But it's a preview of, I think, what we can see coming with climate change, which is the big storm. And that's already breaking, starting to break over our heads. Let me close with this. I think there are reasons, I'm not sure for optimism, but certainly for hope. And I think that to cite those, the rise of women in American politics is one of the big signs. The engagement of young people and the beginning conversation of something being called the Green New Deal. And one of Wes's colleagues, I think influenced heavily by Wes, Stan Cox, has written a wonderful book on the Green New Deal. But it's beginning to look at how we solve what Wendell Berry once called for pattern. So when we implement solutions, they solve for more than one pattern. And then I think there is a new spirit rising, and I think John Lewis captured it. It is to cause good trouble, necessary trouble with good people. And let me just close by saying it's really an honor to be with good people, causing good trouble, necessary trouble, and with all of you watching in.
Thank you, David. You're inspiring me already, and I can't wait to have Wes's reactions to your thoughts about the kinds of changes of politics or legislation, especially for agriculture. Wes, maybe you could talk to the 50-year farm bill and politics.
Well, yes. David always does a great job at outlining the history. He's the most encyclopedic member of the so-called movement. There's no question about that. Just to add a little bit that I think I'll call it a big bit. I've been working a lot with Bob Jensen, who's recently retired from the University of Texas. And we're working on an idea that has not been advanced very much. And that is the problem of what we think is the fact that we are in an apocalypse and have been for 10,000 years. We haven't known it. We haven't identified it. But 10,000 years ago, we became a species out of context. And then we thought from that moment on, we tend to think things have been getting better. Well, better in what respect? We quit being Stone Age people. We began to have more calories available with agriculture. We began to have tools both for farming and for killing with the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. We've been around with the big brain for 150 to 200,000 years, and we've had agriculture only 10,000. The Bronze Age and the Iron Age is 5,000 years ago, and then we get into the coal, the oil, the natural gas. And what I think is not paid attention to enough, and that is the deterministic nature of the highly dense carbon, that we are a moral species, and we're constantly thinking that our failures are due to some improper moral behavior. And what we have not acknowledged is that there are some things we cannot say no to. And then we try to rearrange the chairs on the deck of a sinking ship, thinking that if we move more chairs this end, then we'll last a little longer than if we leave the chairs back there where it's really sinking. So an apocalypse in the sense of the New Testament is really not the best understanding of what it means to live in an apocalypse. Things are bad. They've been getting worse. And it has to do with a kind of a power structure that we try to negotiate. And if you look it up, you will see that this is the word apocalypse itself goes back to the Greeks. And then a synonym is revelation, and that's Roman. And it has to do with how you maneuver with a power structure. We are never going to get it right, but we can do better. And that's what it means to live in a fallen world. And that's what I think our Hebrew ancestors were trying to tell us. Now, I think we've been working, it's not that we're working in the wrong places, we're not working enough in some other places to look to. So as folks that know the Land Institute realize that the problem of agriculture is very different than problems in agriculture. And had we set out to work on the problems in agriculture, we would have had early funding from the power structure. But we chose to work on the problem of agriculture itself. And doing that, what did we do? We looked to nature. We looked to nature's ecosystems. We looked to a planet's way of doing business for, well, 3.45 billion years is about where we see the beginning of the journey, or the close enough to recognize life, the journey from minerals to cells. So what does that tell us? Well, the politicians don't think that way. Short-term thinkers do not think that way. You start talking about developing perennial grains grown in mixtures, which is the way the prairie would operate. You hear such things as, good luck on that one. Well, when we first published on this, I said, look, this is going to take 50 to 100 years. And I have to tell you that from coast to coast, there were folks that are saying this is not impossible. The planet will either allocate its resources to seeds or to roots, but it can't allocate resources to both. And we challenged that. And now we have the evidence. But where did it begin? It began by looking to nature's prairie, where no fossil fuel, no chemical contamination of the land and water. With species diversity, you have chemical diversity, which means it takes a tremendous enzyme system on the part of an insect or a pathogen to give you the epidemic. You know, so now we have, and I can get into our the results to date, but that has inspired Bob Jensen and me then to look to a creaturely worldview. And when we do that, we begin to get new sets of ideas on how we might think about managing an economy. And it turns out that some of those ideas include the sort of thing that E.F. Schumacher was onto and Leopold Kohr. In other words, scale. You got to think about scale. We didn't evolve in big cities. There is a certain scale that we had most of our evolutionary history. So just as the Land Institute realizes the problem of putting chemicals out there into our fields, that chemicals that our tissues have no evolutionary experience, in a similar manner, you don't put together economic, political, and cultural arrangements that are inconsistent with our evolutionary past. And that journey, we're on that journey now in what we call the Ecosphere Studies Program at the Land Institute, headed by Aubrey Strike Krug, who did her PhD work at the University of Nebraska. She's in charge of this project. And we have Bill Vitek over at Middlebury College that's also working on this worldview. And of course, Bob Jensen, and that I just mentioned. And so the larger point being that we're looking for looking for how we can be inspired by what we see within the way the world has worked all these billions of years. And from that, we began to get some ideas. Now,
let David respond to that, because I'm very curious from David's perspective, involved with policy, politics, and law, how we can devise institutions that are more responsive to the living ecological world. Yeah. And be more in harmony with it than perhaps sure. Disaligned as we currently
yeah.
have.
Yeah.
Well, there are issues of scale, it seems to me, and Wes is right, and there are issues of time. And the fact that we face right now, we're in the middle of a pandemic, that and climate change ahead, which are maybe the sum total of our previous mistakes. And so very quickly, we have to resolve issues of how we deal with these at the scale of a nation state and the globe. And I don't have any clever answers for this, but I do remember a conversation that Wes and I were part of in the early 1980s between Saul Menlovitz, who was an international lawyer working with Richard Falk and did great work at international law and the World Order Models Project back in the 70s and 80s was there, his work with Falk and others, and Wendell Berry on the other side. And Wendell quoted William Blake about the minute particulars and the global generalists, and Saul Menlovitz with some heat responded about the need for top-down legal structures and politics, and Wendell was arguing for the bottom-up approach. And Gary Snyder at that meeting got irritated and threw his bundle of papers on the floor and said, enough of this, there's only one way to solve this, and that's on the volleyball court. Now, I don't remember where the global generalists or the minute particularists won, but the question still stands. How do we do the public business in a way that honors what Wes is talking about, locality, or Leopold Kohr, about smaller units of governance? That's not where we've gone as a world. It's maybe where we should go or should have gone, but that's not where we are. So now we have to think of ways at which these two scales and everything in between can be melded into some kind of coherent and solvent, ecologically solvent or sustainable and hopefully resilient world. And I'll leave that as a question. I'm sure some of the viewers may want to weigh in on that, but I think that's one of the issues that hangs over us. Were there better ways to organize human affairs way back when? I'm sure there were. Can we take advantage of those now? Possibly. Should we begin to pursue all of those options? Absolutely. And understand those breakpoints and branch points. But this is the perennial problem of governance. And Madison once made his very famous comment about if we were angels, there'd be no need for governance. But we're not angels.
Yeah.
We're human. We are fallen, as Wes says.
Yeah.
And so we need some structure around us of laws, institutions. And we see the last thing I'd say is this. I think that structure has the question of inclusiveness. How do we bring people into that conversation? We all saw the killing of George Floyd, and that put a bright light on an aspect of American life that's been present since 1619 that we now have to reckon with. And if we don't reckon with that, it's going to make everything else much, much harder. So this is the last thing, because I think this is a bit like a quadratic equation. You have to solve a lot of the components before you get to the right answer on the right side of the equals mark. I'll stop there.
Well, it's a good thing you did, because now I have something to say. things are changing fast right now. We're not going to know how fast this change is and how lasting it is. The longer this lasts, then paradoxically, the shorter the length of time necessary for the change that we need. For example, one of the big problems associated with this pandemic is social distancing, having the social distance. And all you got to do is look at the newspaper or look at the MSNBC, the maps and whatnot, and you see where the virus is, and the virus is around big cities. Now, let's remember what happened starting at an accelerated place, this side of World War II. People were leaving the land. The populations went down fast, and they moved to the cities, partly because of the highly dense carbon that made it possible to live in those kinds of circumstances. We have a lot of small towns and rural communities throughout the Midwest and Great Plains, houses that were built, and some of them still there. It's going to take a lot of repair. But we're land animals, so there's we start with the creaturely reality. We're land animals, and we are going to have to get more people back on the land and develop a community life and begin to get scale that is more compatible with our evolutionary history. There's that creaturely worldview again. So in a certain, somewhat limited sense, but not too limited, I think this, look, I'm 84 and I'm a candidate to die fast if that disease hits. So I know that. But in a certain limited sense, this is concentrating our minds in a way that, like waiting to be hanged, will concentrate the mind. I'll just say one other thing. If, many of you will remember reading Lao Tzu and Lao Tzu telling about living in a village. And in that village, he had never been to the adjacent village, but he heard the rooster crow every morning. In that village, he had never visited. That's a peculiar kind of statement. How is it that he was living in that village his whole life and not going next door? Could there have been enough viruses come through that part of China? Because if you look, listen to more of the Tao Te Ching, here's what you hear. Tao rules heaven, heaven rules earth, earth rules humanity, and humanity lost the way when we began to substitute our designs for nature's designs. And somewhere along the way, and I've tried to find this lately, but I heard this, I don't know, 40 years ago. The goal is to get in harmony with the local eddies of the cosmic breath. The local eddies of the cosmic breath. And I thought of that rooster. And I'm thinking about the plague. Is it that the, as H.T. Odom said, that the encoded language of behavior moves into our systems? He said the encoded language of behavior facilitates the transfer of energy through systems. And he was looking at, well, why the Indians refused to eat their sacred cows during their famines. What I'm getting at here is that here are patterns that develop as a consequence of a kind of necessity. And that didn't require any political machinery. That just required being sensible that don't go over to that village, you might get something. We have a history of that. So anyway, I can talk about the 50-year farm bill too, but I'll stop there.
Can I respond to that just a minute?
Please do.
No.
we're long past the point in human history where you're not going to go to the neighboring village. That's a good story, and it tells an important truth, but we've passed that. And I want to come closer to this issue in the pandemic. Mount Pelerin, after World War II, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and a group of economists met at a place in Europe in Switzerland called Mount Pelerin, and they established what we now know we call neoliberalism. And it said very frankly, very simply, that markets should rule. The government should step back. And so between society, civil society and markets and governments, markets ought to be the determinant factor. And that is pretty much taken over. When Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, that philosophy was embedded in everything that happened. And so we deregulated and so forth. So what Wes is telling is true and is very informative. But there are things that more immediate to our situation that explain things. We bought the wrong economic model. I'm sitting behind my house. I have to carry insurance policy on the house for the event of any small chance of large scale events, lightning or windstorm. But we carried no such insurance on the global economy. And yet we knew long ago that pandemics would occur. Larry Garrett wrote The Coming Plague in, I think it was 1994, and that was 25 years ago, call it. But we knew long before that even that plagues, that when you move heavy things long distances, one of the things that it will hitchhike with those things in that global economy are plagues and viruses. And so we bought the wrong economic model. And so would that have solved everything had we stayed with the model? And Wes's story, which I agree with, how do you get people back on the land? That decision won't be made until capital is available to do that. Markets support that, but those are decisions by and large that will be taken both in the marketplace, but also above that in governments. And we've been operating on the wrong economic model for a long time, and including the idea that the economy should grow without limit.
Yeah. Well, there's a little...
Both of you are kind of raising questions about how the small scale can be guided or even directed and governed by the large scale. The, you know, how can a small is beautiful ethic be cultivated, and how make that a large scale movement or even something supported by institutions of democracy? It seems that we're kind of in a political wilderness right now in terms of actualizing that kind of a vision, or where do we go from here?
Well, David is using a sound argument that the very argument itself, which is sound, is wrong. And that is, we need to hurry. And whenever you need to hurry, you almost always try to hurry. There's a tornado coming, get to the cellar. There are bombs that are falling on our town, go get somewhere. The hurry is always going to take precedent over a longer term. We understand that. That's part of being a creature. But as we are hurrying to the cellar with the tornado coming, hurrying to the cellar with the climate change, we sometimes forget what we're going to do when we come out of the cellar, or what we're going to do while we're in the cellar, or what we're going to be thinking about. And so we have emergency planning. And then we fail to ask, how did this happen in the first place? So if we're not asking the right question or dealing with the certain realities of the culture. I mean, just one reality in a culture is that in 1660 to 63, the Royal Society came into being. And the Royal Society is a big part, of course, the Enlightenment. And what was their motto in Latin? Don't trust anybody. And so, don't trust my cell phone either. Sorry. So here we have the idea that you don't trust anybody. You do this experiment, you get your data. We also have, though, Jesus of Nazareth, crucified, dead, rises from the dead, is out on the road somewhere. And Thomas says, I'm not going to believe it unless I can actually see the wounds and poke my hand in where the wound was. And Jesus says, you, and then he says, I believe. Jesus says, you have seen and believed. Blessed are they who have not seen and believed. So here is validation of faith without evidence. Now, those are two things rubbing up against one another in the culture. And as a consequence, right now, we have more people that seems to me are willing to accept on faith that we're going to get out of all this. It may make a difference in the election of a president rather than stick to facts. Look how this has, how this plague has been effectively ignored. And so we haven't dealt with this problem of evidence versus faith. And I'm not saying we give up on faith, but I am saying that we have got to figure out a way to come to terms with that, even as we're running to the cellar with the tornado coming. And we're not doing that. We're going to get to that cellar and we're not going to know what to do. It'll be dark down there probably.
Wes framed it differently. I'm not sure that there was a disagreement in that. No one's going to argue that when your house is on fire, you sit around and talk about architecture. So there are times when you do hurry, and there are times when you need to pick up the pace. Should we talk about the origins of the fire or the source of the problem? Absolutely. So I don't think there's a serious argument there. I think the issue that a society faces when you have 7.5 billion people, you do have to pay attention to the scale of the problem that you've created and begin to take preventive measures where you can. It's simply common sense. The idea you take no thought for tomorrow doesn't really cut it when you get down to those kinds of issues. You do pay attention. It's called foresight, and societies can have that kind of foresight. So I don't think there's a serious argument there. I think that we have to get we have to understand the origin of the issue. And Wes's work has gone back very deeply into the origins of the problem of agriculture. That is extremely valuable work. But it doesn't allow us to ignore the problems of feeding 350 million Americans today and tomorrow that are in the middle of a pandemic. But I think the point of understanding how we got off track and what the alternatives are, what do we do now, is really the operative question. Can we lay out a plan? This is why I like Wes's 50-year farm bill. It did talk about extending the time horizon of thinking about farm policy that is going to be absolutely essential. But the same thing is true elsewhere. But to understand that, you had to understand how you got into the mess in the first place.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a serious argument there, and I'll relinquish the floor there.
Yeah, sure. Look, all I am saying is that with the about climate, we are not doing what I think is necessary also to figure out how are we going to live. There is right now the belief that when this virus is over, we're going to go back to normal. Well, if we go back to normal, we're getting right back into it again. And so it's a matter of sort of expanding the boundary of consideration that, as we put it before in one way, that overlaps the boundary of causation. And those boundaries of causation are not being adequately looked at. That's all. I mean, David and I aren't arguing. Well, all we're doing is trying to explain the range of it all. And I think right now there's a big deficiency in the range.
I agree with that. I don't have it. And I think most of the people likely to be on this or watching this have spent their lives doing their professional work trying to understand where we go, not return to a status quo. And I'm going to add to this just one other slight small story. There's an old tale called the Tale of the Jinn, J-I-N-N, old Islamic tale. And in that tale, humans are in a dock. We're on trial. And in the jury box are fish and birds and bugs and so forth, given voice and sentience. And we have to make a case for our existence on Earth with all the roadkill and damage that we do in the world and so forth. And I used to ask my students in the environmental studies intro course to be the lawyer for humankind to make the case for us. And their first impulse was, oh, there's no case to be made. And then you come back and you remember there are people like Mozart and Shakespeare and Martin Luther King, and there are reasons why we should survive. And the point of that is simply to say, and I think you're right, and this is just reinforcing what you're saying, that if we better knew why we deserve to be sustained, we would know better how to go about sustaining ourselves. And it is that thing that you're talking about. When you come out of the cellar, what do you do? What's the thing that justifies human existence? And I'll rest my case with that.
Let me take this moment to pivot to some audience questions and try to get some other ideas injected into this conversation. One that seems to be very on point on this discussion is Kate Raworth's book about donut economics as a way to translate out of the prevailing neoliberal economic approach to something that is more compatible or driven by living systems. Could either of you respond to what donut economics has some promise, and also the related challenge of how, with everything accelerating toward large-scale centralized structures driven mostly by capital and money, how we can have an approach that favors relocalization on appropriate scale?
Let David answer that question. You know where I am on it.
I like Kate's book. Let me start with the last part of the question, and this has not been part of the conversation so far, but Shoshana Zuboff last year published a book called Surveillance Capitalism. It's a 500-some-page tome, basically that is showing or arguing how we are losing control of the human future because of technology. And there's nothing new in that. That's an old issue, but I think it has come into a brand new phase. And the point of her book is to say that, and it's kind of like reading Thomas Piketty's work on capital. It's just a big tome that explains a lot of structural issues. But a world run by algorithms where we have effectively no choice is the world that is being built from Silicon Valley and their equivalent companies around the world. And so that's a world where we lose agency and machines take over our decisions and the fundamental decisions. And we're probably further down that road than most people appreciate, but that's now popping up in hearings in Congress and so forth. On Kate's book, I don't have it here in front of me. It's been a while since I read it, but I remember liking it a great deal. And it has, there's a long pedigree going back to John Ruskin's work and up through more recently Herman Daly's classic work on steady state economics. We know what an alternative economy looks like. And it has to be ecologically solvent. It's got to work within the boundaries of natural systems. It's got to be a circular economy. As she writes, it's got to be fair. It's got to be somewhat resilient, that it can handle various kinds of things. And I think Wes's story from the Tao Te Ching is apropos. It's got to be a world where there are firewalls. And that's part of the function of the local community, but where ideas and culture can move, but there's some things that don't move. Labor can't move easily, but capital can, and therein lies a serious issue. So localized economies, where capital stays within that local market, are going to be an important part of that world. I'll stop there.
Well, it's. I think the motive behind that kind of question is, where do we start to begin? Where do we get traction? Where do we plant our feet to try to start to go and build a different pathway forward? And I know that we have some general intuitions and general ideas that both of you have shared with us. Do you have any specific ideas with kind of a short or midterm approach for developing a new pathway?
I do. Yes. Put a cap on carbon and keep lowering that cap. And I mean at the mines, the wellheads, the ports of entry. And this will, of course, require at some point rationing. But until we put that cap and impose limits, and this is the first species on planet Earth that has had to impose limits. The limits usually come by having too many people and you die off or some predator gets you or whatever. But if we don't put that cap on carbon, instead of fiddling around the edges with cap and trade and this, that, and the other, that's just a way to keep things going. And the second part of that, though, is to acknowledge that if you take care of the problem, at the big place where the entry point is for all that carbon into the culture, then you have fewer moral decisions that have to be made down the line. There's something to the avoidance of temptation. I mean, that's actually scriptural. So one way I put it is, let's say you put your hand over your head and you put your fingertips together, and then you have a little teepee up there at the top. And then if you start moving together the part between your hand and your arm, you're getting it smaller. Now, as you get it smaller, then that's less carbon coming into the system. And what is below the various decisions below that point? I hope you're all doing this now out there, because you will see that that as you squeeze in, you actually may be moving your elbows in terms of the carbon use, but you also may be moving, could move your elbows out in terms of increasing your cultural capacity. In other words, get some metaphors that will help us appreciate the need to acknowledge the imperative of highly dense carbon. The spirochete goes to the light. There are you watch your cats and your dogs and the birds flying into things. They're not thinking. They're just doing. They're responding to the what is. But we have, I think, developed huge, huge moral codes as the consequence of the fall. And when I can get into Moses coming out of Egypt and the number of laws that he had to put in, like 600 laws on land use and so on, the larger part being acknowledge deterministic reality of the availability of the carbon. Then you don't have to be fooling around the edges so much with what kind of an economic order are we going to have for the distribution of justice.
David, what kind of short-term or mid-term strategies might you recommend? And let me just add into this another question from the audience about what skills or disciplines do you think young people might want to prioritize for helping deal with our crises?
Okay, let me start with Wes's point. I could not agree more. And Stan Cox's book on the Green New Deal makes this point, I think, really well. Carbon has to go. The question is, how does it go? And it will require political decisions. This is where politics is going to be critically important. We will have to take carbon off the books. So what historical examples do we have where something, buddy, or some country has taken something off the books as a positive asset and either just removed it entirely? And the best example I can think of is the way the British in the 19th century handled slavery. They simply remove slavery as a category. And to do that, they compensated the slave owners, not the slaves, but the slave owners. And so the slaves were freed, the owners were compensated. Now we fought a civil war and we're still fighting that civil war. But what happened in the abolition movement in Britain was very political. This was a long movement, but it culminated in a political decision and then a policy that required compensating. So were we to take fossil fuels off the ledger books, simply there, first of all, there, it's why, I think we have to ask, why do we assign ownership of something they didn't make? They don't produce oil. They extract oil, as Wes has pointed out. So that is one thing, to take simply phase fossil fuels out. At a certain point, it's illegal to burn coal, oil, natural gas. And it is a public resource. The question then for the public arena is whether we compensate or confiscate, whether we purchase and reward the owners at the Exxon Mobils, or we simply say, no, you can't have that anymore. You didn't make it. You don't own it. It falls back into the commons, to coin a word. That's in your beta way. Now, to make that reality, fact is Jane Mayer's book, on dark money. Fossil fuel money has corrupted not just our atmosphere, but our political process that determines how our atmosphere is allocated. We have to get to a political decision for which there is a majority of public opinion to take money out of politics. If you run for public office, it's funded publicly. And it's simply illegal to give contributions, or certainly dark. The other thing I would say with this, I think in a lot of ways that alternative economy is happening. Wes and I, and you and probably everybody on the call, have been in local restaurants that are supplied locally from farmers still doing quite well, meeting the local demand. And if I remember correctly, farms in the Northeast, due to a lot of good work from friends of Wes and yours and mine, are doing quite well meeting local demands. That's a growing market for local production, organic and local, it's fresher and so forth. The skills, Wes wants to find the skills that a young person needs as the skills of homecoming. And I thought that was a very nice way to phrase that and say, what do you know how to do or to make or to grow or to be when you come home? And right now, the skill set in higher education, and I've been kind of what people call a loving critic of education in that realm, but we educate for abstractions that don't do you much good when you get home. I remember, I'll close by saying this, I gave a talk once to a group of university students in a communications program, and I said, I really don't have a talk to give, but tell me what you think you have to communicate. I know you know how to communicate. What do you have to say to the world, and why should they want to hear it? And there was a long silence, and then there went into a very long discussion. But I'll leave it at that.
Well, it reminds me of a line from Wes's lecture in 1993, where you talked about how do we reclaim our nativeness? How do we know our place? And you said our task is to build cultural fortresses to protect our emerging nativeness. It must be strong enough to hold at bay the powers of consumerism, the power of greed and envy and pride. We have to call the shopping malls and Walmarts what they are, the modern cathedrals of secular materialism. And you had at the time said, well, maybe universities or others should be bulwarks against this. Tell me now, Wes, what you might think of how we reclaim place, refine place, cultivate those identities and place-based commitments.
Well, if this were the 60s, the answer to that question for a lot of people would be drop out and turn on. And a lot of folk did drop out. But it wasn't sustained except in places like New England and a few others in the Ozarks and whatnot. This is one thing that seems that we were naive about back in the 60s, in the 70s too, in the 80s, and we're maybe even more naive now. But we actually believed that what it took to end the Vietnam War could be used to solve the so-called environmental problem of the time. We said we've got to quit burning so much gas. And we had the Carter era years, which went away in a hurry. What I think we're learning is the total interpenetration between the whole network. We'd been so used to living in a reductive manner and using reductive parts to solve problems that we didn't understand that something like climate change sums the whole problem best. That is the big summary of the whole thing. And so we have continued to peck away at that. So this is calling, I think, for the fundamental. I think this is the great moment, what some have called the great turn or the big turn or whatever, because what we're going to do is hope to take with us all that we have learned, say, all the way from the Big Bang to how the galaxies are formed and the planets and and how we've learned that, as George Wald put it, we living things are the late outgrowth of the metabolism of our galaxy, and the carbon in our bodies is cooked in the remote past of a dying star, and from it at lower temperatures came nitrogen and oxygen, and these were spewed into space to mix and form planets and we ourselves. And the ancient seas gave us the pattern of ions in our blood, and the ancient atmospheres molded our metabolism. We know all that now. Now, the question is, can we hang on to it and become a new kind of gatherer and hunter? And practice the kind of restraint that's necessary, and so on. So, as I said earlier, we're never going to get it right. That fallen world is here as long as human beings are here. It's a question of, can we do better? And that's what it means to be living within an apocalyptic state. And so that psychological change where we, you know, we want to hang on to so much of that knowledge, but at the same time, we're going to have to spend more time digging potatoes and spend more time doing what our fossil fuels are doing. I mean, I've used this as an example several times. Here's a ditch, and the plumber hears that the toilet is plugged. The plumber has 25 people with shovels, and he has a backhoe. What does he do? Well, some would say better use the 25 people with shovels, but the toilet is plugged. And so you can get that backhoe to get that job done, say, within an hour. On the other hand, a subdivision is going in, and you have a backhoe, and you have 25 plumbers. There you use the 25 plumbers. You have no business.
You're talking about an epical cultural change, really. And David, yeah, you're sort of involved in that with some of your projects, the recent book that you might tell us about in terms of renovating democratic culture as a way to be a force on this.
Well, eventually, whether it's around a tribal campfire or a city hall or a state legislature or Congress, we have to come together to make certain decisions. And so the transitions that we all want to make eventually have to go back to some decision-making mechanism. And this requires overcoming what Maggie Thatcher once said, something, there's no such thing as society. Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were arm in arm in the neoliberal economics. And I think we will have to overcome that adolescence, that we're simply atomized individuals. We will have to collectively decide to protect, as your work is on the commons of atmosphere and oceans and biological diversity and soils. These are things we hold in common. So somehow, and this back to the question on education, this has to become part of our dialogue. And I think, again, the good news in a lot of ways for this is that if you put this to the public, even at this fractured time in our history, most people are in agreement about most of the things we would consider to be important. But the bridge that connects, again, what we want and what we get on the other side of the chasm has been broken or rendered into a toll bridge. I don't think our situation in some ways is as desperate as it might appear. But I've gotten off the a bit off the topic, but rebuilding the culture will require, and there's a chicken or egg argument, where the culture rebuilds the politics or the politics help rebuild the culture. And I'll leave it at that. Danella Meadows used to talk about points of leverage, and she had 10 of them. And the least effective was to argue about politics, and she put that up here. The most effective was change paradigms down here.
Right.
But the problem she had was that the Voting Rights Act was up here. Its effect was down here. The Voting Rights Act did change culture. And so they're not as easily separable as she argued, although it's a classic, wonderful essay.
Yeah. But
it requires this dialogue back and forth. I think our tendency is to draw lines and say it's either or. It's not. It's seldom either or.
Yeah. I promised that I would say something about the 50-year farm bill that I think fits in here. The Green New Deal may offer a framework to incorporate the 50-year farm bill. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is when I first published on this back in the 70s and said it's going to take 50 to 100 years, you didn't find people clapping. We got problems now, and why should we wait? Well, we don't know how much we're going to be slowed down, for instance, by this virus and some other viruses. So maybe we can take advantage of some longer term thinking. I mean, the very fact that the economy gets slowed down can give us the time to think about longer term solutions.
And what are the structural, Wes, what are the structural changes that you want to see either in the way agriculture is conducted or the way that it's governed through external institutions?
You say, what are the structural changes?
Yes, that you would like to see.
Well, I would like to see, I come back to, we evolved as land animals and the tribe wasn't very big. And I see a small town as a large expansion of a tribe, and that the relationships among people, it didn't mean that you were kissing and hugging and making everything come out even. It simply meant, and Leopold Kors said this, there's always going to be conflict. There's always going to be wars, he says, but at least you have something that you can manage within the system, if the scale is small enough. And so the kind of structural change I see is, as a matter of a practical necessity, we've got to get more people moving back to the land. And I see that $1 trillion has just been accumulated for people to buy land. And what are they going to do with it? Well, in some respects, it's good for just a very few people. Having made that investment, it'll be easier to take it away from a few people than to take it away from a lot. So, I mean, we shouldn't just throw up our hands. But I think there's got to be a resettlement of the countryside that is as fast as the unsettling of the countryside. I mean, if it went that way so fast, why can't it go the other way so fast? And there are some reasons, of course. But until we get that in our imagination, that we need to repopulate the land as a matter of a practical necessity, not mere nostalgia. And an Amishman told Wendell Berry once, you know, we can get the horses back, but where are we going to get the people? And the people he's talking about is having the cultural capacity to know how to work the land. And therefore, here are all these small liberal arts colleges that I saw something in the Council of Higher Education or somewhere, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, that 40% of them are going to be bankrupt by 2025. All right. There are roofs there. There are places where we could be re-educating people to go home or to go to some place and dig in. But if we can't imagine them doing it, then we're not going to work for the policy to make it happen.
Well, we're approaching the last 10 minutes.
Can I make one comment?
Sure.
And it seems that we haven't talked about race and income. But to repopulate and do serious structural kind of changes, I think we have to get serious about solving or resolving the issue of race and distribution of income. The fact is, distribution of income is roughly where it was in 1929, at the threshold of the Depression and the market collapse. And race, as we've learned to our horror, is not getting better. In some ways, it's gotten apparently worse, although there are some positive signs. But I don't see any big cultural shift unless we can directly deal with those issues. And I don't think, again, I think the Green New Deal is an awfully good start for reasons that I think all of us would agree to. But the most attractive thing for me is it does seem to try to solve or address multiple problems with single solutions. Wendell Berry's, again, phrase of solving for pattern.
Well, that's a nice springboard into, I think, some concluding reflections by both of you, and maybe you could keep them just to 3 or 4 minutes apiece. But what directions or visions would you have that are hopeful for starting to address some of these deep structural issues, in Wes's case, epical existential questions almost of the human condition, but also of politics, law, policy, and the conduct of commerce and agriculture. What do you see as primary avenues forward?
Well, go ahead, David.
Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah. Now I forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Can you? Well, you were asking, big conventional ways that are currently here that we may draw on. I see the ways that are afoot in places like Vermont, mm-hmm. where you have a kind of a different culture that has local organic communities supported, people that just like to do that. The book Against the Grain by Yale.
James Scott.
James Scott. I mean, he tells, it's not in that book, but in one of his others, where he's talking about people that have gone to the cities and then just go back into the countryside on their own. This is not for them. And kind of disappeared. I think it's something like 100 million people I saw on one of the films, films I saw on TV. What is it that caused them to come to that position? And it could be, as things get worse, that people will begin to figure out ways to get back to where they can be secure enough by growing enough of their own food. And then an economy will develop. And that doesn't require much of our current institutions to give them the nod to do that.
I recall that the title of that book was The Art of Not Being Governed. And I think that there's a certain paradox there in terms of having the self-determination from not having remote external institutions directing us so much. But
yeah.
I digress.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to respond to that, I don't know where the disagreement is. Wes said I was involved in big conventional solutions. Not so.
I didn't say that.
I think you okay. I think
I said it better than that.
You probably did. We'll argue about that offline. But
no.
The people that 100,000 that can afford to move to Vermont made money in the city, and then they packed their money up and left.
Yeah.
But I'm raising two issues that I think we have to resolve before there is any decent, survivable future. One of those is going to be, how do we get along with each other across racial and ethnic and religious boundaries? We have a president now currently exploiting those boundaries. And we have whole industries where people make a very good living by keeping us angry and at each other's throats and selling us weapons to kill each other. I think we're actually closer together in the real world than we otherwise might believe. And the other thing is simply income distribution. If I'm poor and in the city, Wes, I don't have the money to move to Vermont.
Yeah.
And so you struggle. And I think the income distribution issue is a real issue. And then in building an economy that works, there are a lot of people on this that are watching this that are part of rebuilding local economies. And I mentioned a little bit ago, I think that's one of the really exciting things going on. The local foods movement, the local economy, but it will be devastated by the current pandemic. to get out of it, apparently we have to have major government support in the trillions of dollars to put a safety net below that. Yeah. But there had to be that government to be able to step in to deal with that emergency crisis. So it's I'll rest the case there. But I think one other thing I would say is this. There are these branch points in American history. Roosevelt's State of the Union speech in 1944 is one of those that laid out the eight freedoms that we should share. And we were, I think, closer at that point to a shift in American society. It didn't happen. Roosevelt died, and there were other things that occurred in war and so forth. But I think that there are branch points in the history. We should understand what went wrong with those. I think in the 60s, we were, again, close to those kind of structural changes. The Vietnam War was our, at that point, the impediment. But I think we're a better country than we believe ourselves to be. And I think the people watching, and David, your work, and Wes, your work, are part of a mosaic of solutions for that better country. I'll stop there.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your deep wisdom from many, many decades of grappling with these issues. Thank you for giving your time. Thank you for sharing this with the hundreds of people who did tune into this.
Thank you for listening to the Schumacher Conversations. To hear more from visionary thinkers in the new economy movement, and to discover 40 years worth of Schumacher lectures, visit our website at centerforneweconomics.org. You can strengthen our mission to bring about a just and sustainable global economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate, or by purchasing pamphlets of your favorite lectures at centerforneweconomics.org/order-pamphlets.